Hi everybody, this is Dr. Keith back again talking about DietWise from the reading room. Now I've got to confess here that this is a re-recording. Originally I was away from home when the third in the series was done, and I was at a friend's house. I thought she had a handset, or a headset I should say, with a special microphone that would improve the quality. Anyway, long story short, she didn't, so I did the call anyway, just through a handset. It wasn't so good, the audio, and I always promised that I would come back and redo that. I didn't actually promise a gap of nearly 3 years, but anyway, here I am, fulfilling. So I'm going to take you through the next step in the book DietWise and the procedures that we go through. And this is the part where we get down to the nitty-gritty action, as it were, what we do, how we do it. Just to remind you, the caveat for these readings is that I'm not really just reading from the book. I don't think that's very fulfilling. You can just open the book and read it yourself. I'm using the book as a sort of prompt and a thought guide, and often it will lead me to say more than is in the book anyway. So I think that's better for everybody. We've done so far the technical stuff, the background stuff, you know, what I've explained, a masked allergy or the hidden allergy phenomenon, and why we have to unmask that. To be able to do that, you have to clear foods from the system for at least 5 days. It depends on the person's bowel habit, basically. If you've got regular bowels, it usually takes about 4 days to clear a food through the bowel. So you've got to remember, if you're eating it more often than every 4 days, it means there's always some inside you. That's why it hides. So to test properly, we have to exclude the food for at least 5 days. Actually, 7 to 10 days is better. And I say to patients, be prepared to go for 2 weeks if necessary, especially if symptoms are clearing. But a trial diet or a test exclusion diet isn't really a failure till you've gone about 2 weeks and had really no change at all. At that point, it's fair enough to deduce the fact that you're not eating any allergy or inflammatory foods. I mean, there could still be toxic foods or still foods that are not good for you nutritionally, as is the case with a lot of manufactured food and so on. Okay, anyway, as I said, we're going to come down now to the actual elimination diet step and how that's carried out. We're starting out from the assumption that something could be a food. If you work through the inventory I gave earlier in the book, then you might have some very strong pointers to the fact that it almost certainly is, or probably is, or perhaps could be, and so on. But the bottom line is, it's worthwhile anyone doing this any time, especially if you're chronically sick, because if you have a disease like arthritis, for example, that's been going on for years and you're taking medication, and obviously, by definition, the medication is not working. If it was, the condition would go away. I'll remind you of my definition of successful therapy, which is no symptoms and no treatment. If the treatment worked, then you won't need to go on doing it. So if you're carrying on doing it, it really wasn't a successful treatment, and certainly not a cure in any sense. And also, it's no bad thing for people who view themselves as pretty healthy to actually go through a program like this. You can be surprised, and just because you're in a healthy phase of your life doesn't mean to say you're not harboring stressful and inflammatory foods that sooner or later can start, will drop you into trouble through starting up symptoms. So, you know, why wait till you're sick? You could try it now. If you remember the story of Luigi Cornaro, who modified his diet and gave up foods that he found were stressful, he called them rough foods, but it enabled him to be healthy, well, and vigorous for decades. He made it just 2 years shy of a century, 98 years old. That was pretty exceptional in his day. I think it's good for anyone to do that anytime. Okay, so I'm talking now about elimination dieting, sometimes called an exclusion diet. It was first pioneered in the 1920s by an American doctor called Albert Rowe. And since then, many doctors have gone on to verify and extend this brilliant work. The classic text on the subject is a book called Food Allergy that was published in 1951, and the authors were Herbert Rinkel, Theron Randolph, and Michael Zeller. These were three brilliant pioneer doctors. Now, I've got to say, let's be logical here, okay? Just avoiding a food, let's say you have migraine headaches, avoiding a food and the migraine headaches go away, that's great, but it's not enough. Just avoiding things is not enough. The getting better or recovering or a symptom going away could be a coincidence. So it's very important that we follow through after the exclusion step by doing what we call a challenge test, and that is you take a substantial dose under test conditions of the food and see if it brings the symptoms back. I'll explain how to do that in the next section. Of course, I explain it in full detail in the book DietWise itself. And that's very critical. If you don't do the challenge test right, you could miss fantastically valuable information. You see, your body will tell you what it likes and what it wants to eat if you follow the right procedure. I'm not talking about addictive desires from your body or cravings. I'm talking about the fact that if you avoid it, clear the food, and then submit a challenge test of the food, that your body will make it very clear with symptoms if it's something that's a problem to you. And of course, you shouldn't go on doing that. Okay, so the whole procedure, if you like, we could christen elimination and challenge dieting. Some doctors view it as the sort of benchmark for allergy. You know, some others think blood test is the benchmark, or let's say allergy and intolerance. But there are problems even with making this kind of procedure the benchmark, because if you don't do it right, you might miss an allergy. There are catches. If you don't avoid the food for long enough, then you're still in the hidden allergy range, so when you eat it, it masks itself or masks any reaction. Another significant liability is if you wait too long, the reaction can die down. So when you try the challenge test, you try eating the food, nothing appeared to happen. But in fact, it is a problem food. It's just that, you've not had it for so long, the reaction has died down. I learned this elimination challenge procedure from a British doctor called Richard McInnes. He was a great pioneer in this field. He'd earlier written a book called Eat Fat and Grow Slim, which anticipated the Atkins low-carb and high-fat diet by about 15 years. McInnes was a psychiatrist in a major British regional hospital, and he put lots of his patients through this regimen and found, you know, there were really astonishing results and people recovering all over the place from what was supposed to be mental illness. So, in fact, his paradigm-setting book, the one I read, was called Not All in the Mind, because patients were being told that it's all in their mind, they were screwed up. And in fact, it was just eating something, an inflammatory food, or it could be chemicals and other things, but inflammatory foods are far and away the most common, that was making them feel sick. It had it was published under a different title, by the way, here in the USA. It was known as Eating Dangerously. I think it's long out of print, but if you ever come across a copy, it's a very interesting historic book. Now, the elimination plan that I'm going to center this talk around is a version of what we sometimes call the Stone Age diet or the caveman diet. It's even been given the very sophisticated name of the Paleolithic diet after a book that was published of that name. I think it was the late 80s, maybe early 90s. I always called it the Stone Age diet, and I was in the media and on TV, radio a lot back in the 80s in Britain, and they used to call me the Stone Age doctor at one stage, and I used to joke, that's not fair, I don't, a little bit of grey hair, but I'm not that old. Anyway, it's important to understand the principle here, okay? We're going to follow a diet. We choose the caveman diet because we think it's man's natural diet, and therefore it's a relatively low-stress diet. If you think of a hunter-gatherer walking through the forest, what did they eat and drink? The answer is that they would have fruit and, you know, berries and roots and leaves. They would occasionally catch an animal, so have some meat, occasionally catch a fish, so have some fish, and they'd drink water, and that's just about it. All other foods are really not natural. They're what I call farmer foods. So we're going to use the structure of a Stone Age-type diet or a caveman-type diet as the test diet, the test exclusion diet. Now, it's important to remember that this isn't a diet for life. It's a trial diet, okay? It's very important to understand that. There are two aspects to this. One is testing and challenging and figuring things out. And you'll find that, yeah, although the diet, there's quite a few things to exclude, the diet will actually help you feel better, and then you'll be able to narrow down and focus in on which the real troublesome foods are. At that point, you can reintroduce everything else back in again. You know, let's be logical. If you give up 20 foods, you feel better. It doesn't mean all 20 were to blame. It may only be one or two or three. So the trick is to find out which are the real culprits, and then the rest are fine. Just go ahead and eat them. So the long-term diet or the maintenance diet is much less strict than the one that we're going to be using for the test phase, okay? And I've got to say, even if we find two or three heavy problems, you know, heavy hitters, bad foods that really are inflammatory for you, you don't have to avoid them for life. If you avoid them for a few months or maybe a year or a couple of years, the reaction can die down to the point where you can occasionally eat the food, so you don't have to be very strict. I do warn people that you can't go back to eating this food every day, otherwise pretty soon it'll all flare up again and the inflammatory and disease process will come back. All right, now before we go on to the exclusion diet, let's look at the logic of this, okay? Let's talk about fasting. I don't want you to fast, but just follow me with the logic. If you give up eating all foods and you recover, then it's 100% certain virtually that food was the problem, or at least the food was part of the problem. And in fact, when people fast, they often feel terrific. People do it for a variety of reasons, sometimes as a detox, sometimes just for a religious exercise. But most people feel terrific on a fast. They believe that they'll feel hungry, miserable, tired, and so on. Well, you do for the first few days. That's just to do with withdrawal symptoms. But interestingly, by about the fifth day, all that goes. You feel so vigorous and energetic, and the mind clears. That's something that's very important, especially to people who care about beating the aging process, that instead of being tired and miserable and hungry, which is what they expect, they actually report such a fantastic zest and clarity of mind that they either never known or they had, but they'd forgotten that it existed. One of my patients, I remember, said, I could have appeared on Mastermind. That was the sort of TV quiz program of the day, the biggie. And I suppose now it would be Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. You know, I could have appeared on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Despite all these good points, you might be surprised to know that I don't actually recommend a fast, however logical it is, because people can get themselves stuck, especially people who are fighting disease. All right, a healthy person is on a religious regimen, that mightn't be such a big deal. But if you've been sick and your body laid low for years and then you go on a fast, you can end up with quite a bit of a problem, which is almost everything you reintroduce seems to make you sick. And it can become confusing. It doesn't mean all the things are ultimately going to be the problem. They're not exactly necessarily what you're looking for. But, you know, it seems that way, and it seems that everything is a problem. So it can be difficult. Also, there are certain people who shouldn't fast on any account. People, you know, of diabetics, of course, shouldn't. They need certain control of their blood sugar. Pregnant women shouldn't do it. Anyone who's very debilitated, and in terms of mental conditions, anyone who's attempted or threatened suicide, or anyone who's been diagnosed with schizophrenia, because, believe me, these reactions can be very, very extreme. It will astonish people. But I've seen, first of all, on the withdrawal phases, I've seen people on a bed just shaking violently as if they were going through something like heroin withdrawal. And then I've seen people with what are, to all intents and purposes, psychotic breaks when they try to reintroduce certain foods. So it needs a balanced person who, you know, can survive the severe ups and downs and vicissitudes like that without going off the deep end. Could be dangerous for them. So I certainly wouldn't, I would absolutely forbid a fast on such a person. There is a compromise with that, though. What I call a half fast. That's eating a couple of foods. The classic for this is lamb and pears, which is great if you're not allergic to lamb or to pears. I mean, those foods are chosen because they're pretty unusual. I mean, you know, it's unusual for them to be inflammatory or allergy foods. Obviously, if you're allergic to red meat, you might find that lamb's a problem and that won't work. So it's like the whole of exclusion and challenge dieting. It's really a question of playing the odds. It's statistics. These are likely to work, these are not likely to work, and so on. But everyone's different. The book does explain to you what to do if, you know, one of the exclusion regimens doesn't work for you. It doesn't mean you're not allergic to a food, by the way. It doesn't mean there are no inflammatory or banded foods, but it might mean that you're reacting to something that you're being permitted to eat. We don't have that problem on a fast, of course, but as I said, for good reasons, I don't want you to do it. The lamb and pears is a bit extreme, but if you feel really determined and you want a fast result, try it, and if after the first 24 hours you're not feeling any worse particularly, then the chances are you'll be okay with those foods. The benefits of the half fast is that it's quick. You know, you'll only have to wait 5 days before you start reintroducing foods. If your symptoms are going to clear, they will clear very quickly like that. Because, as I said, it's almost like a fast. It's just fasting with some food, if you like, a couple of safe foods. Now, there is a variation, a sort of halfway house between the fast or half fast and the exclusion diet I'm going to be describing in detail. And that's what I call the eight foods diet. What you do is pick eight exotic foods. Now, by exotic, it doesn't have to come from Mongolia or Sri Lanka or somewhere, Patagonia. It just means things that you don't normally eat and things that are not connected with common food groups that you are eating. And what I usually do is sit with a patient and choose eight reasonably appealing foods. So we want a couple of meat foods, a couple of vegetables, a couple of fruit foods, and a couple of starch foods. And then what about a missed? Oh, fowl. You can have fowl too. Okay, so you want unusual things. So for the meat, you might want to choose things like rabbit or venison. It's often a question of what you can get your hands on, quite frankly. Fowl variations. You want to avoid chicken and the whole turkey family. You could eat goose if you don't normally eat it. But there's also ostrich. There are whole ostrich farms in the U.S. anyway, and in various parts of the world, which rear ostriches just for the meat for allergy patients. You want some unusual vegetables, so not your everyday things like courgettes, zucchinis, as the Americans call it. So pick some relatively rare ones. And the same with starches. You must avoid the grains family. They're where the trouble is. But you've got quinoa, if you don't regularly eat quinoa. It's not in the grass or the graminaceae family, but it has a seed that looks almost exactly like millet. And if you soak it in water and boil it, it softens, and you can use it in place of rice. So that gives you the satisfying sort of starch feeling. Other foods like that can include buckwheat. Buckwheat is not a wheat, despite its name. It's actually in the rhubarb family. You've got palms like sago, tapioca foods. So there are always exotic alternatives where, you know, you won't get hungry, okay? So there's something to eat. It may be completely and utterly boring, but at least you won't starve. So that's another variation that you can use if you want. But I recommend, unless you're feeling very, very vigorous and very challenged by your condition and demand a fast answer, and an unequivocal answer. You see, the less you eat, the less equivocal the result. If you narrow it down to just a few foods and it doesn't clear, then it may not be an allergy, or there may be some other factor than food allergy or intolerance. But generally speaking, because the common foods are the common troublemakers, 90% of the time you'll feel better, which is pretty good odds, I must say. It's really good odds. Okay, so let's go on then to the Stone Age diet or the Paleolithic diet. As I said, remember this is only a test diet. You need to run this for about 10, or if you can stand it, 14 days before you quit and draw conclusions. But this is the important point. More than the vast majority of patients will feel better on the morning of the fifth day. And it was like I was a magician. I predicted this and I was right. So often patients were amazed, but it's actually very easy. It takes 4 days to clear your bowel of the food. So on the fifth day, all the withdrawal symptoms go, your other symptoms go. You feel great. The person often feels fit and well like they've never felt in years. Once you reach that stage, then you can start reintroducing things. Okay, so we're looking for a diet that you could stick with for 14 days, but don't be gloomy. You may not have to. Okay, let me start by a list of the things that you need to avoid. First of all, and this is the big one, you're to have no grains, nothing from what the grass family, the graminaceae is their Latin name. And these are the ones that you're very familiar with. Wheat, corn, barley, rye, oats, rice, and millet. Okay, now I don't want you to have substitutes such as spelt. People will tell you, oh, that's okay. It's not. It's a kind of wheat. We don't want to cut any corners. We want a proper result, and you get quite a lot of cross-reaction to something. In other words, things that are similar will cross-react to things that you're definitely intolerant of. Don't take the risk, okay? You can avoid it easily. I'll explain to you. There's plenty to eat. You don't need this group of foods, although this is what most people are addicted to. You know, this is bread and pizza, pasta, cookies, and so on. You've got to. It's the most widespread group of foods in our whole diet. Wheat alone, as I said, occurs in bread, cakes, cookies, muffins, pastry, pasta. It's also in odd things like whiskey and other spirits. You've got corn that shows up in corn bread, but it's in hominy and grits and cereal flakes. It's also in soda as the high fructose corn syrup that's so notorious. It's used as a common binder, and it even occurs as a binder in white pills, meaning that if a person's intolerant of corn, they're going to react each time they pop a medication. It's very ironic. The next biggie, and it's another big biggie, is we don't want any dairy products, not even at this stage, goat's milk or sheep's milk substitutes. You might be fine with those. About 50% of people who are intolerant of cow's milk seem to be all right with goat's and sheep's milk, but you don't know which 50% you're in, so don't take the risk. The commonest allergy in the group is the protein called casein, and that's in all milks anyway. Some people are sensitive to the fat part, of what's called the phospholipid portion. And again, dairy is very, very widespread in our typical diet, and it's often hidden from view. Apart from milk, we have it as butter, margarine, our spreads, cream, ice cream, yogurt. These are obvious sources, but it turns up in things like fruit juice, believe it or not, lacto-fermented whey. You meet whey in all sorts of places you don't expect it. Just remember, that's a dairy derivative too, so be careful. We don't allow stimulant drinks. That means no tea, no coffee, and no alcohol. Plenty to drink, but not those particular ones. Again, you only have to stay off these things long-term if it's a problem. You know, if coffee is killing you, why would you want to drink it anyway? But this is the only way to find out, is to give it up for the program, okay? Now, I'd like you to quit smoking. It's easy to say that, I know, but you can't seriously improve your health until you do. It's such a toxic habit. It's by far and away the most addictive of the common social poisons. Tobacco is invariably a masked allergy or hidden allergy effect. The person is smoking to keep the symptoms away, and if you don't smoke, the symptoms come on with a surge. Well, I'm sure you know that. But, you know, you'd be surprised at what smoking can contribute to. All kinds of conditions. For example, if you've got migraine or headaches, you should know that 50% of people with migraine, the migraine goes away if they just stop smoking. So bear this in mind when you're dying for a puff of a cigarette and you're finding it a struggle. It could be most of the problem to you. You won't know until you stop doing it, wouldn't you? Okay, now we don't want any sugar or substitutes for sugar, okay? Any white sugar, brown sugar, not even natural sugar, honey's not allowed. But I don't want you to use substitutes like stevia and aspartame and sucralose and all those things. For one thing, you don't need it. You'll see that none of the allowed foods actually need sweetening. It's pointless. But also what I encourage people to do is to get rid of their sweet cravings. Just get rid of your sweet tooth, if you like. After a while, when you've had no sugar or sweetening in your food, you'll find that a carrot actually will taste very sweet. We're not going to allow egg. This is a wonderful, strange food, but allergy to egg is one of the most curious and extreme things that I ever came across. It's almost bizarre. A person who's allergic to egg can react violently to kissing someone who's eaten an egg. You can cut a cake that's had egg in it and then cut somebody's safe egg-free cake with the same knife and they still get a skin eruption or some other sensitivity. It can be extremely sensitive like that. Ovalbumin is the usual offending protein, and that occurs in all eggs. So again, turkey and duck eggs and other substitutes, not at this stage. Okay? Now also, I don't allow chicken. I'm not just thinking here of estrogens and chemicals and antibiotics and all that stuff. That's bad enough. But also cross-reactions can occur. Chicken and egg, of course, are the same animal. And so sensitivity to one might be the same, you know, might cause a likely reaction to the other. I found that you could eat capon, that's the male bird, if you live in a rural district and want to take the trouble of tracking it down. But frankly, I wouldn't bother. Just use some of the other fowl. We'll see that you can have turkey and duck and goose and so on. I don't want you to have citrus fruits. With lots of fruits to eat, but not that particular family. That means orange, lemon, grapefruit, limes, you know, those. Now, that might seem strange, but in fact, they're very powerful chemicals if you think about them. If somebody cuts open a lemon or an orange at the opposite side of the room, you can pretty soon smell the pungent odor. And generally speaking, you know, powerful chemical substances are the very stuff of which inflammation and allergy and intolerance reactions are made. So just avoid that family, okay? Orange is very high on the hit list. It's certainly in the top 12 or so, maybe in the top 10. And then last but not least, this is a really important one. I don't want you to have manufactured food of any kind. That's nothing from jars, cans, or bottles, or packets of any kind. Nothing altered, nothing smoked, nothing flavored. Just eat your food as nature made it. So it's hard, I think, for the layperson to grasp the sort of criminal extent of how much adulteration goes on in processed foods. It's not just that the food, you know, all the essential nutrients are removed wholesale, which they are, and then they try and lie to you and say they've, you know, with added vitamins. They take out 90% of the vitamins, well, 99% of the vitamins, and then give you 3% back and say it's vitamin enhanced. I mean, this is ridiculous. If you're walking down a street and somebody grabbed you and robbed you of $100 and then the mugger turned to you and said, I'll give you $5 back, you're $5 enriched. I don't think you, don't think you'd accept the math on that, would you? But that's what food manufacturers are doing, in effect. But it's not just what they're taking out. As I said, it's what they put in. It's a very elaborate topic, and I haven't got time to go into all that. But just take one example, polyphosphates. These absorb water, so manufacturers pump these into the food, which will then soak up water, and it weighs more. If you take bacon or ham, they're actually selling you up to 45% water because of these polyphosphates. That's why when you fry bacon or ham, it very, very quickly shrinks. All the water boils away and you're left with a little wrinkled piece of bacon. It's fraud. It's just straightforward fraud. But, you know, there are all sorts of things added that are called improvers that are really only improve profits. They don't improve the validity and nutritional value of the food. And lots of things to enhance the appearance. I mean, canned peas you would not dream of eating if they weren't dyed green. They look a disgusting browny gray color, very unappetizing. So, as I said, all these food additives, and none of them are for the customer's benefit, although they claim they are. They're for the manufacturer's benefit. They want to sell you garbage, basically. For the same reason, you should always be wary of what are called natural food additives. What do they mean by natural? You know, beetle cases like cochineal or burnt feathers and seashells are actually added to ground up added to food. And they say these are natural. Well, they're not. They don't belong in your food. I mean, they may be natural substances, but they don't belong in your food, right? You must be especially aware of the problems with the glutamate family. I think most people know the story now about monosodium glutamate. But beware, manufacturers just lie. They know that customers are very wary now about monosodium glutamate and that family, the aspartame family. Aspartate family, I should say. So they have on the label things like no added MSG, no MSG. Sometimes it's ammonium sodium glutamate, so it's just in the same family. Sometimes it's there in another form, or they've added hydrolyzed vegetable proteins and things like that, which are all just monosodium glutamate under another name. So it's very important you avoid those, okay? Now, a word about drugs. This is a difficult one. I am not your prime care physician, and it's not my place to tell you what drugs to take and what not to take. but it is my place to tell you that you must sit down and have it out with your doctor and don't be put off by baloney. Don't get fobbed off with doctors taking the attitude of you're too stupid to understand. It's your body, it's your disease, you're taking the medication, you've got all the risk of side effects and death from that medication. You should demand an explanation and a justification for it. The fact is there are very few drugs that you couldn't just give up for this trial period. I can only think of a few, like insulin or thyroid hormones, epilepsy drugs and so on, digoxin maybe. But all the rest, you know, the painkillers, the tranquilizers, the antihistamines, the antacids, the sedatives, hormone replacements and all that, they're not strictly essential, and you could just as well try this exclusion program without them. The problem is, you see, it's not just the possibility of reacting to drug substances or the actual medication itself, but it's the things in the capsule or the pill. I've already hinted, for example, cornstarch is present in all white pills. That's usually what makes the white pill stick together. So if you've got a headache due to corn allergy and you take an aspirin, the headache isn't likely to go away because, you know, you're swallowing more corn. So it's always better to try and avoid these things if you can. Also, avoid natural and holistic remedies. These are very complex substances. Herbs, people think, oh, they're herbal, they're soft, they're gentle, they're holistic, they're wonderful. No, they're not. Lots of them are extremely poisonous. marijuana, opium, hemlock, all kinds of poisonous, deadly substances are just herbal in nature. So it's just naive to assume they're all safe and simple. Again, the same philosophy. Just avoid them in case they're a problem. If they're not, then you can go back to using them. And by the same token, you should avoid nutritional supplements like vitamin and mineral formulas and so on, because these are complicated by food ingredients. Vitamin C, for example, is derived from corn. So if you go on swallowing vitamin C powder, you're really continuing with the corn, and it will fail to unmask. You might miss it on the challenge test. Vitamin E is often derived from wheat germ, as you know, and vitamin B comes from yeast. You can get synthetic forms if you want to, but that's really for later. Just for the short range thing, what's the problem really? Okay, now the last ban. Well, I've already mentioned stimulant drinks. We don't want you to have alcohol. I'm not just being puritanical, but alcoholic drinks contain a lot of foodstuff substances that you're simply not allowed to take. Wheat and corn and sugar, for just examples. If you drink vodka, people suppose that it's potato. It was made from fermenting potato in Russia. But modern vodka is made from wheat or corn or both and sugar. You can hardly be wheat or corn free if you're going to continue taking those. You see, the alcohol actually gives it more of a bump. Ted Randolph used to talk about alcoholic drinks as jet-propelled food allergies. You know, they hit you. It's not just the same problem. It hits you really hard because of the presence of alcohol. Okay, well, let's dump the bad news. Let's go on to what can you do. And there's lots. First of all, you can eat any meat whatsoever. First of all, you can eat any meat. That means beef or pork, lamb. You can have rabbit, venison, any other meat you come across. Interestingly, I found that bacon and ham weren't really a problem for the people in the UK I was dieting, but looking at the typical American cured products here with so many strange chemicals and flavors, I can't really recommend them at this experimental stage. It's best to be brave, okay? You can eat fowl, obviously not chicken, I mentioned that, but you can have turkey, duck, quail, and game birds like grouse and pheasant if you're so inclined. I think they're a bit smelly, and as I said, you can get ostrich steaks. You just have to Google those on the internet. They're being prepared specially. You can have any fish or seafood that it's in its natural state, but do avoid smoked fish, even if it's properly smoked, you know, over a fire and chips and so on. Most of it isn't properly smoked, in fact. It's just synthetic flavoring, a mix of dyes called Kipper Brown, also known as Brown FK and Chocolate Brown FK, or various, contains a horrible mixture of azo dyes. You don't want these. Okay, just avoid smoking of ham, fish, or anything like that. Smoked salmon might taste delicious, but it's all a fake flavor. Okay? Now, I've said you can have any fruit except citrus. That leaves plenty of fruits. And these days, supermarkets will import fruits from all over the world, many of them quite exotic. And they just simply weren't available to us a few decades ago, but now there are dozens, if not hundreds. We've got things like kiwi and papaya, mango, fruit of Chiron, that's a variety of persimmon, star fruits and lychees, all kinds of exotic melons and Asian pears and pluots and all sorts of things. Just be adventurous, you know, think outside your normal habits, basically. And again, all vegetables are allowed, right? So this includes all salad foods, and again, there's a huge variety of there of roots and leaves that are available in the modern supermarket. The colored ones are best because they've got more antioxidants, but that's really not the issue. You know, we're not talking about nutrition in food here. We're talking about avoiding things that are a problem. It's much more of a deal than trying to get foods with good nutritional ingredients. You can use flavorings, so things like, you know, garlic, curcumin and other things, onion, all these things you use for, and herbs like thyme, basil, oregano, and so on. Those are all valuable. Those are just fine whole foods, so there's no problem. You can have a rutabaga instead of ordinary potato, and if you want, instead of rice. So when you'd normally use rice for a dish, use mashed rutabaga instead. And we often mash up cauliflower. If you slightly overcook it so it softens, and mash it with the potato masher, you'll find it does a really good pinch hit for rice. And, of course, there's sweet potato, the one that the Spanish call batata, and yam, which is very similar but not the same. Listen, you can fry things. So you can have fries if you want, sliced potato and fry them. Then you can slice your sweet potato into rings like penny circles and shallow fry them. There's lots and lots of things you can do. Try and get organic if you can, but I don't want you to get hung up on organic. As I said, it's really avoidance here, you know, avoidance of certain foods rather than whether or not the other ones are good for you. Later on, you can, I mean, if you can get organic, that's fine. I'm just saying it's not a stipulation here. You don't actually need it necessarily. Now, there are one or two little loopholes here. I allow certain canned or packaged foods, very few, but these can be very useful exceptions. For example, just canned fish like canned sardines or salmon or tuna can be fine. And canned tomatoes too, that's okay to add to soups like, you know, minestrone and things. And frozen fish and frozen vegetables, those usually come in a packet, but generally speaking, those are okay. Just be aware of the fact that things like, for example, packet fries often have sulfite in them. Some other sterilizing agent, bisulfite, it wouldn't be listed as an ingredient, but it might affect you if you're sulfite sensitive. And then for the purposes of the diet, we allow dried fruit and nuts. Again, nuts in their natural state. You don't want dry roast peanuts because that's treated with all kinds of chemical and food schlock. And beware about dried fruits. If you take apricots, the nice golden shiny dried apricot is actually a liability. Because it's bleached and the shininess comes from a mineral oil, not so good. A dried apricot in its natural state is actually rather a blackened lump. It looks like cat poo, but it's actually much healthier for you. It doesn't have all the other additives. Okay, now, as I said, I don't think I did say, but let me say it now. This is not a slimming diet, so I don't really care how much you eat. If you feel hungry after a meal, what I say to patients is cook the whole meal again and eat it twice. You will lose weight. It's interesting because if you give up addictive foods and especially some of the carbohydrate starch foods like the grain family, you'll lose weight anyway and you can eat a lot. I mean, if you're hungry, just eat. That's the rule, okay? And yet you'll still steadily lose weight. You typically about 2 pounds a week, which is rather good when you can eat as much as you want and lose 2 pounds a week. That would be great. I'm okay with spices and condiments. I don't have a problem with people eating spice foods. A lot of doctors, especially if you've got digestive problems, will warn you off spicy foods as if that was the cause of the problem. It's not. It's going to be something like wheat or milk or coffee or one of those. And when you avoid those, you find you can take spicy foods really hot. You can have a full-on Tex-Mex or Indian and Thai curries and so on. So go ahead with those. There's no reason that you can't enjoy your foods. There are lots to eat. I mean, absolutely lots. There's dozens of readily available meats and dozens of fowls and literally hundreds of vegetables. I Googled these and found in a typical supermarket about 400 available vegetables. So, you know, when people complain, they often say pathetically, but what am I going to eat on this diet? I'm not very sympathetic. I tell them, you know, get a grip. the kind of the typical foods that you eat are so repetitive. I wonder why people bother. You know, bread and muffins and pastas and pastry and pizza, these are all wheat foods with or without the yeast. Corn turns up with all kinds of things like soft drinks. It's in instant coffee, cornbread, polenta. That's also in pasta and pizzas and tortillas, cornflakes. To me, that's very repetitive eating. So I think the appeal of varied eating should outweigh what is really very boring eating. And people often look pathetic when they think, you know, what can I do for breakfast? As if the only conceivable breakfast was these, what I call sort of cardboard fluff out of a box. They just look like pieces of cardboard, you know, cornflakes and things like that. They're not very nutritious, and to me, they're not even very appealing. What's wrong with the idea of eating some chops or fish or fried vegetables at breakfast time? I have a saying that if food is healthy at 6 in the evening, it's healthy at 8 o'clock in the morning. But when I suggest breakfast like this, I must admit people sometimes look at me as if I just said a dirty word. But really, it's just a question of habit. If you were a caveman living in Stone Age times, your breakfast would be the same. It would be fruit or vegetables or meat in the morning, the same as it would be in the evening. And I encourage you to completely throw out, and for the rest of your life, these breakfast cereals. They're rubbish. Most of them are absolutely soaked in sugar. Did you know that 30% of cornflakes by weight are actually sugar? And then things like Frosties and so on, it's even worse. It's up to 50%. You just don't need this stuff. And, of course, it encourages you to take dairy produce, which is a problem. If you took it with soy milk, it may be okay for some. But still, I would encourage you to get rid of the sort of cereal breakfast mentality and think of something healthier. There's also a question about drink. People can't imagine a life without drinking tea or coffee or being able to have a gin and tonic when they feel like it. Well, first of all, there are lots of waters that you can drink, Perrier and Pellegrino and all these sort of designer waters. They're okay, although they're very expensive. You can get home-filtered tap water. Especially, I would recommend that you use the reverse osmosis principle. Don't use distilled water. It's demineralized too much. And you're allowed fruit juices in moderation, obviously not, you know, orange juice and lemon juice and so on. Those are in the citrus family. But you can have apple juice, grape juice, pineapple juice and so on. Just make sure you get brands that say no additives. And be careful because they often add lacto-fermented whey, which is a milk product, as what they call a preservative. You want no added anything, no nothing kind of wording on the label. You've got lots of herb teas. Take this chamomile, mate, peppermint and so on, South African rooibos bush, but I recommend you avoid mixtures because they often include citrus zest, and that, again, that wouldn't fit with avoiding the citrus thing. Okay, well, is this tough? Is it a tough diet? It's certainly, you need some determination. I wouldn't say it's tough. I mean, for example, if you're chronically ill, I would say it's no worse than feeling ill most of the time. The point is, it's the first few days that are tough because of withdrawal symptoms. After that, you will feel so good, you'll be glad you did it. You'll have renewed energy, zest, and vigor. People were coming to me in the early 80s saying, wow, you know, my friends are saying, what are you on? You know, you look 10 years, 15 years younger. And people did look younger, and they felt younger, and their mind was clear and so on. The rewards are very great for doing this. And remember the story of Luigi Conaro, who lived so exceptionally long simply because he made a habit of avoiding foods that didn't suit his body. It's simple, okay? Just get through the withdrawal phase and you'll be fine. Okay, and now I want to cover one other specialized topic which is of dear to lots of us, especially if you're a parent, and that's how to get children through this program. It can be important, okay? Kids often suffer very badly with reactions to food. It's like being poisoned. I mean, suppose, you know, you can't fend for yourself much as a kid, but if your parents and teachers, you know, the people in charge, they just insist on pumping you full of what's effectively a poison and making you feel lousy and sick and fretful and dazed, then they blame you for misbehaving and being naughty when you can hardly even think straight because of this food phenomenon. It wouldn't be fair, would it? But that's what a lot of kids have to endure. Milk allergy, for example, in kids is very common. Corn allergy is commoner than wheat in kids. Often just phases the kids to the point where they can't think straight, they can't study straight. And I wish educators and parents, of course, but I wish they understood what I know and what I've seen happening with children and just how disastrous for children eating the wrong foods can be. There are so many fallacies about food. You know, kids have to have milk because it's full of calcium. It's absolute nonsense. The calcium is barely available, and a lot of kids are made so sick by milk that they actually malabsorb, meaning they're not absorbing any nutrients. It upsets their gut and their digestion process. What's valuable in milk is vitamin D, but hey, you don't need the milk for that. You can take fish oil or just vitamin D capsules. That'll protect the kids' bones. There's lots of calcium in food. There's another fallacy which often affects kids and the way they're fed, and that is the idea that sugar provides energy. In fact, sugar saps energy faster than anything I know. It gives what appears to be a short-term lift, but in the long term, the person suffers low blood sugar, and that makes them profoundly tired, completely lacking in energy, so you need more sugar, and then you go hypoglycemic again soon afterwards, and so on. The things that are done to kids are really absolutely appalling. And then all this brightly colored junk that manufacturers believe makes it attractive to kids. Well, let me tell you something I learned about kids over the years, which is if they're tired, they don't want to be sick, and they're a lot more intelligent than adults give them credit for. And if you say to a child, look, try this diet and exclude these foods, and you might feel better. Your skin rash might go, or your tummy upsets might go, or your asthma and wheezing might go. Most kids will give it a shot, and I found actually discipline among kids isn't the problem. It's discipline among the adults. You know, maybe mommy wants to try the diet, but daddy is behaving like a so-and-so, and he insists on sneaking food to the kids behind mom's back. Or the parents are both united in wanting to do it, but grandparents are sneaky and think it's cruel to not feed this kid food, sweets and junk food. So they will slip it in without the parents knowing. These are the kind of problems that you're faced up with when you're dieting with a child. But as I said, if you'll find, surprisingly, you can trust the child more than you think. But what I would advise you to do is actually join with the child if you're going to use this. This program is great for children, you know, with attention deficit disorder, behavioral problems, and mood disorders and so on. It's absolutely great. You should try it. You owe it to the child to try it. And also, if their school grades are not so good, you owe it to the child to try it. But I would like to encourage you to go on the diet with the child. There are certain good reasons for doing this. One is the child won't feel so peculiar and strange and sort of singled out. If there are any siblings, you know, brothers and sisters, make them go on the diet too to support the patient child, so that they don't feel out of it and nobody's getting candies and nobody's getting ice cream. It helps the child not feel so much out of it. The second advantage is that you will be able to understand better what it is that the child is going through. And it can be tough in those first few days, as I said. But believe me that, you know, if the child feels well, the child is then going to be... I've seen children actually refuse chocolate and candies from some irresponsible adult saying, oh, no thanks, I can't eat that. You know, that makes me wheeze, or that makes my skin go bad. It's amazing. There are signs that might tell you, might warn you that your child could be, you know, in this frame and have this kind of problem. And one of the most outstanding ones I know is a picky eater. You know, a child who just picks at food, they'll eat certain things, but you put food in front of them, they just kind of pick it over, and they don't want it, and they're not hungry, and then half an hour after the meal's cleared away, Mommy, can I have a candy bar or something? You know, that kind of thing. That's very characteristic of this food intolerance, food inflammation disorder. Also, what are called growing pains. There's no such thing as growing pains. People grow without pains. What are called growing pains are pathological, in other words, disease pains that occur at the time when the child is growing. There is no connection between the two. And almost invariably, the problem is a food. You sort the diet out and take out, say, you know, typically dairy produce, the growing pains go away. Look for disturbances of mood, you know, abnormal temper tantrums. Listen, we all can have temper tantrums, but if it's really bad and have what we used to call paddies or tantrums, or moodiness or crying, or especially look for a child that's very high and on the go, always moving, very restless. This might be a sign of food allergy, food intolerance disorder. There are certain very striking signs. A person would look pale. They have a runny nose. They sometimes have a crease across the nose from pushing their nose backwards. Because of the mucus, a child will raise their hand and push their nose back and go, and that's called the allergic salute, because their hand goes up, right? And they also will sometimes have what we call allergic shiners. That's like they've got black eyes, the dark rings under the eyes. It's very characteristic when you see it. Person is very pale in the face, but they have these puffy eyes, swollen eyes with dark rings underneath, allergic shiners. That can be a very, you know, that can be a giveaway too. Okay, so apart from that, a child can generally cope with it. There are one or two exceptions, as I'll describe in a minute, but usually a child can cope with the exclusion program pretty much as I've described it. As I said, the problem is going to be the people around the child, typically. Even family and friends and everyone might be united, but then you get snotty teachers who think they're above the parents' ruling because they have the care of the child during the day, that it's their right, their entitlement to force the child to eat things that are bad for them. I would try and restrain the tendency to go and punch a teacher like that, because there'll be legal repercussions, but that's about what they deserve. You've got two choices. You either fight them on their own ground with letters and lawyers' letters and so on, or you just simply keep the child at home. Say the child is sick, and for that period, health problems, you could say, so that it's not even a lie. Okay? So there are certain sort of relaxations and sort of eases, as it were, for things with children that I do allow. I certainly will not permit, you know, candy and sodas and all the usual junk, but, for example, rice cakes. Because rice cakes are, I don't know if you've seen rice cakes, it's expanded rice that form in a sort of biscuit shape. They look a bit like polystyrene roof tiles. But they're actually quite tasty. They'll be even more tasty depending on what you spread on them. And there are certain things available, like, for example, pure peanut butter. And if you want it pure, do it yourself. Just simply put it in the food blender and run it. You'll be surprised if you've never done that before. The peanuts will go to crumbs, of course, then eventually go to powder, and then all of a sudden it turns into a paste. If you did it yourself, then you know there's nothing in there. Okay, you can spread that on a rice cake. You can also get what are called whole earth type jams. There's a nice French brand called Bon Maman, M-A-M-A-N, Maman is French for mummy, and this is available in the USA. There are lots of others like that, but just don't fall for the sugar-free jam kind of thing, because that usually means it's got corn syrup as a sweetener or sorbitol or other sort of synthetic things. What you're looking for is nothing in the jar but fruit, and you'll know that because it'll tell you to keep it in a refrigerator. See, the sugar, the high concentration of sugar is there to prevent the fruits rotting. It just kills any mold or bacteria that land on it. Just sucks the sugar, sucks the water out and kills it. So if you, without the sugar, you need to keep it in the fridge, otherwise it will spoil. There are certain treats that I've described in the book. I haven't got time, well, in fact, it doesn't work trying to give verbal recipes, but for example, we tested and used over the years two or three serious treats. One was peanut butter squares. It's really just taking the mixture of peanut butter and the non-set honey. You get the hard honey, but then melt it so it's soft. Then you stir it with the peanut butter. You can put sesame seeds in it, dried coconut if you want. And then you stir these together and spread them on a tray and put it in the refrigerator. When it chills, it will go solid, and you can slice it into cubes. Make really nice sweeties, but I warn you, they won't last more than a few hours. But those are great for kids. We have a thing called banana treat. This is really very simple. You just take a medium to large banana and just slice it in two lengthways so it's like two slices of bread. You spread pure peanut butter, the good peanut butter I've been talking about, in between the slices, sandwich style, and you put the top strip back on, and then you can drizzle over that some pure honey and sprinkle it with sesame seeds. Those stick to the honey. It's absolutely delicious, all natural. You could even say it's a Stone Age food, because cavemen did occasionally get access to honey. You can make a sweet potato pudding. Just shred or grate sweet potatoes. Cover them with soya milk, which is permitted. Oh, yes, that's another thing. Soya milk is, we think, not good long-term, either for children or for menstruating women. There are various hormonal-type problems. But listen, just for 10 or 12 days I'm talking about on this diet, no problem at all. and add a teaspoon of maple syrup or so, and then just bake it in the oven till it goes soft and mushy like a rice pudding. But in this case, it's a sweet potato pudding. There are lots of treats that you can do, you know, things like that, which will help a kid out. As I said, fries are allowed. You know, it's not a slimming diet either for adults or children. Fried food is okay, so fries are okay, but just don't buy the commercial kind. A better idea is to make your own. You can have coconut spuds or potatoes. Just take a large baking potato, preferably organic, a garlic clove, and some. You want some organic virgin coconut oil per person. You melt the coconut oil in a large baking dish first, and then you peel and slice the potatoes and with the garlic, and you know, mix them all together, and just throw them into the oil, and then put them in the oven and bake them. When they come out, just scatter some organic sea salt on it. If you need, only need to cook these for about 20 minutes or so. Baking is better than frying. It's really, really delicious. Trust me, it's fabulous. You can do the same kind of thing with sweet potato, using, if you want, you can use, scatter some maple syrup on it, but also chop up some scallions and a teaspoon of yellow curry powder can make some sweet potato fries, also very interesting. If you can't somehow get the child out of school, then one of your choices may be, of course, to send the child to school with a packed luncheon that contains the right kind of foods. You've got less control there, unfortunately. Kids will, as you know, will swap treats, and your child might want to swap something that's very unsuitable. You've got little choice but to trust. But as I said, the only thing that I do find is that kids are a lot more trustworthy than you think. They will join you in the experiment if they understand what it is that you're trying to do and why. Okay, well, that's the sort of bare bones, as it were, of the investigative stage, the sort of exclusion stage. There's only really three things that can happen to you at this point. You either feel better, which is great, and I would say that's true for 60-70% of the time. You might feel worse. That's not such bad news. It means it is a food. It means the food is implicated anyway, at least part of the problem. And likely it's going to be something you're eating more of, so that narrows down the target quite a lot. That can help you. And of course it's possible you don't feel any different at all, but it'd be wrong to draw the conclusion that food is not a problem. If you remember the old eight nails in the shoe trap, if you have eight nails sticking up in your shoe, you're going to limp. And if you only take out one or two or three of these nails, you're still going to limp. In other words, the symptoms won't go away. So you may have withdrawn two or three nails and they're still valid. You'll need to go through the challenge test procedure anyway, even if you don't feel any different. Do the challenge test, because often when you return the food, there is a definite reaction. And so it's a food to avoid, even if it's not the whole story. And I'll tell you how to do these challenge tests in the next segment. Okay, so as I said, this is a replacement. There's no questions, no question time on this particular recording, because this is a replacement, but I hope you find it a useful insight into what we do and how we tackle the subject of elimination diet. Of course, let me just say the obvious. If you don't have the book Dietwise, you need to get it. Everything's described in terrific detail in the book. It really is the summary of over 30 years at the top of my game, knowing exactly how to do this procedure and getting really quite miraculous transformations in people. However much effort might seem to be involved, I promise you it's worth it. Even if you're a healthy person, it's worth the effort, because identifying foods that really are not doing you good will only help you later in life. It'll save you building up trouble and breakdown and damage that could come later in life. Okay, this is Dr. Keith in the reading room, signing off, and thanks very much for listening. Go ahead now and listen to the fourth segment of this course. Okay, bye.